Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. May Day, May 1st, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, with Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hello, Abe.
Hi, John.
Gentlemen, we find ourselves 30 years after Ronald Reagan participated, to the shock of many, in helping to depose Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos after a rigged and fixed election. 30 years later, we find President Donald Trump eager and willing to welcome Rodrigo Duterte, the current president of the Philippines, and a man who just hours before the president invited him to the White House, or said he was going to meet him in the White House, confessed to having committed many murders as part of an extra legal vigilante squad in his region in the Philippines, where he was the mayor and the governor, the mayor of Davao City in Mindanao. Somebody who is basically supported the use of extra legal and extrajudicial vigilantes in a drug war in the Philippines, who has trashed the United States, calling us a bunch of bullies and sissies, I think, called Barack Obama, the president of the United States, a piece of trash or a piece of slime, is clearly mentally unstable and won election with not a huge margin of vote, 38% of the vote. So he's not even a sort of dominating political figure. I mean, he's obviously a dominating, but he, you know, it's not like he comes to, will come to America as the, you know, sort of like grand victor of a, you know, in a new order in the Philippines, of course, formerly an American colony. Then after its independence in 1946, the site of the largest military installations in the world outside the United States, and an enormously close ally of the United States, particularly after we participated in the deposition of Marcos and agreed to closing down Clark and Subic, which the two major bases, which were a thorn in the nationalist side of the Philippines. It's an important relationship. It's a strategic relationship. But this is a minor country, you know, second or third level country for us. A lot of us are feeling very disheartened at the moment that the President of the United States would extend, you know, a hand in friendship to a monstrous killer and supporter of, you know, what is the opposite of the rule of law, and someone who is clearly attempting in some fashion or other to destroy the not wonderfully well-ordered democratic workings of an American ally in a important region to us, but nonetheless still a ramshackle but functioning democratic system.
Yeah, we should paint a picture here of what life is like in the Philippines since Duterte came to power. We believe 7,000 people approximately have been killed, either by police or by these militias that are organized at the behest. The actual request on the stump of the president, Duterte, and they're targeting quote-unquote drug dealers, drug users, anybody who's has anything to do with narcotics, narcotic trade, they're targeted for death. There are actual bodies in the streets. Actually, the New York Times had a really devastating photo essay of several months back. The prisons are in extreme inhumane condition. There are images of people piled in stairways on top of one another because the overcrowding is insane. Members of his former administration are rolling on him. There was somebody who talked to the country's Supreme Court implicating Rodrigo Duterte implicitly of responsibility for these massacres. And there's something of a geopolitical necessity here for the president to repair the relationship with the Philippines. Duterte signaled in his populist way a desire to integrate the Philippines into the Sinosphere and a relationship that's closer between Manila and Beijing than Manila and Washington is explicitly not in our interests. And we have a necessity to repair that this relationship, even if it's a little bit distasteful. In the same way, by the way, the left now is very frustrated by the fact that Donald Trump invited, for example, Egyptian President Sisi to the White House because he doesn't have a very stellar human rights record. And in a fashion, I mean, it's an acceptable criticism.
Not just the left. I mean, there are people, including our own Max Boot, who writes on our blog, who were disappointed with the invitation to Sisi. I disagree with Max, and I think that it's silly to say that somebody who has tilted so unambiguously toward the United States in the, you know, after the Arab Spring and is creating a revolution in consciousness about the relationship between Egypt and Israel is somebody that we should be dealing with. But Duterte is a creature of an entirely different order.
Run-of-the-mill political repression is one thing, but this guy praised Hitler. Like, he literally said Hitler.
But by the way, another thing that Trump has done, another thing that you have to understand what it means for Trump to have done this, is that we had an ambassador in the Philippines, Philip Goldberg, I believe, who was an assistant secretary of state, ambassador to Bolivia, long-term foreign service officer, who was having a fight with Duterte about something or other last year. He called him a gay ambassador and the son of a whore. So I understand that Donald Trump is not crazy about the State Department, doesn't seem to care that much about, you know, about who serves in his government, who's not a personal friend of his, but he is the leader of the Foreign Service and the Diplomatic Corps of the United States and the person, the people who work for it. And it cannot be acceptable for a tin pot pseudo dictator to be calling American public servants sons of whores in public because they're having some kind of a dispute about something or other. And the dispute wasn't about something or other. It's about what it means that, you know, that you have a president of a country who is literally not only supporting but may himself be participating in the actual direct murders of people who have not been, you know, not been tried, not been arrested, just shot down in the street.
And you know, the danger there is that bad actors are emboldened by being acknowledged and reached out to by the United States. They take that back. They go home and wear that as a badge of honor, and they sort of puffs them up and enables them to, you know, proceed apace with whatever nightmares they had planned or to launch new ones.
The doctrine of realpolitik says, you know, don't be naive. We have to deal with a lot of bad actors in the world. It's silly to pretend that we can sort of make these decisions based entirely on moral preconditions and the presumption that everyone is supposed to behave, you know, like Caesar's wife. But that does not hold in the case of a somewhat unimportant country to us, and in which a country that needs us much more than we need it. I mean, among other things, the amount of remittance that comes from Filipinos in the United States to the Philippines is a very large part of that country's, you know, balance of trade and the cash reserves that it has and the money that the poor in the Philippines get, not just from us, but from other places. And, you know, if you are, as Cesar Conda, a Philippine-American, says in a piece in the Weekly Standard, you know, if you're a Filipino sending money back home to Duterte, maybe you're not going to want to, or back home to your family in Duterte's Philippines, maybe you're not going to want to send much money because you don't know what's going to happen to it and you don't want to participate in the strengthening of this regime. So we are much more capable of influencing their behavior based on the generally wildly good feeling that the Philippine people have toward the United States. And yet we have a president who is willing somehow to coddle and act as though he needs to have a good and beneficial relationship with this monster thug.
That's, you know, there's a, this is a version of Obama's approach to countries with abusive, tyrannical leaders. He sort of went over the heads of the people who might have had positive feelings about the U.S. I'm thinking particularly in Iran, of course, but elsewhere, and reached out to the leaders, and that blew up in his face.
Well, in Obama's case, he was doing that with the consent of the foreign policy establishment, as misguided as we believe they were, and I think that's fair. In this case, we already have protests from what we understand, according to the reporting, from inside the administration, from inside the NSC, from inside the State Department. There is no geopolitical necessity to legitimize this guy. We can repair our relationships without providing him access to the White House and all the, you know, trappings that entails. And also, you know, I mean, it's kind of intangible, but I was going over this on Twitter over the weekend, you know, throwing out some stuff about how atrocious this is and what an awful guy Duterte is. And you know who reappeared? Very emboldened, very happy about this? The Pepe Frogs. They are thrilled about this. They are very defensive of this guy. Just about every bad actor generates a lot of interest from the white nationalist group. And it seems like a Philippine president is an interesting character for the white nationalists to rally behind.
Because he's a beacon of ugliness.
Right, that's all. Exactly. That's all they like.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, like, right. And it's, yeah, it's just the yeah. reversion. It's the red pill and the blue pill. It's right. the Matrix. So everything that right. seems conventional, you know, you hate, and everything that seems unconventional, right. you
no matter how grotesque. You
I think
support.
The Hitler thing has a, yeah. has a lot to do.
But, you know, but if we
well, that too.
If we think about Trump, if we look at him through the lens that we applied either last podcast or two podcasts ago, where John pointed out that he's fundamentally unserious, and when we try to sort of find serious meaning in the things he does, it's futile, and we're sort of going down the wrong path. So what? With that in mind, what's his thinking here? You know, I mean,
the alarming possibility, and I'm sorry, you cannot discount it, even if you're a Trump fan, is that there are close business ties between the Trump Organization and business interests in Manila. There are Trump buildings in Manila, including an apartment complex that is advertising itself with Ivanka Trump's picture, and one of the people who is involved in that development has been sent to the U.S. as an unpaid economic envoy by Duterte himself personally, and was in Trump Tower during the transition talking to people on the transition team. So there is a pre-existing relationship with business interests in the capital of the Philippines, and here we are 3.5 months into the administration, and there may be here quid pro quo that we see happening. I mean, there's no way to prove it, and that doesn't mean, by the way, that Trump couldn't call him in and yell at him. I mean, there is an argument to be made that he calls him in and he says, "Now you stop this right now." And Duterte, you know, when we're talking about, you know, sort of like the colossus of the world versus a pygmy, I mean, who knows how Duterte would respond?
I mean, the same argument was made to explain away the Trump president's call to Turkish President Erdogan following that referendum, which nobody believes was genuine and valid, and which provided him with unique, when it comes into effect, with unique powers.
Erdogan, not Trump in this case.
Correct, yes. We didn't have a referendum on a new constitution, yeah, right. In case you missed it. But yeah, and then they say, you know, well, you can't really discount the business relationships. I don't, but at the same time, I think he's probably responding to what he believes are America's geopolitical interests. We have a really serious relationship and a necessity of a relationship with Erdogan. We have a really necessary relationship with the Philippines. We need, and it's part of it, by the way, an outreach strategy that encompasses all of Southeast Asia. There are a variety of other Southeast Asian nations.
Okay, so you're defending the realpolitik argument in some sense, which by the way would be comforting. And you know, if in fact it were the case, though, you just can't believe that it's true because you're not.
Well, I think it's a distinction. To Reince Priebus inviting him to the White House and repairing that relationship. You don't have to go that far.
Reince Priebus, the White House chief of staff, said yesterday on one of the chat shows that we needed to have this meeting in order because we need the Philippines' help with North Korea. Now, I don't entirely understand what help we need from the Philippines in relation to North Korea. Philippines don't exactly have influence on the Chinese, which seems to be our one preemptive strike strategy to deal with the North Koreans before they really, before their weapons and weapons delivery system matures. But, if they actually do have reason to think that they can use the Philippines as some kind of staging area for some effort against North Korea, then it would, as I say, not that they're going to tell it, but it would be sort of heartening to know that there was strategy behind this or geopolitical strategy behind this. That does not seem to be the case, and one can't trust that what Reince Priebus isn't doing is just tap dancing in public to defend the indefensible.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think your interpretation is the best. The only thing I can think of is that the Philippines is probably the most combative player in the dispute over these manufactured islands in the South China Sea. Vietnam has some significant interest there. The Philippines have an interest there, et cetera. And they all come into conflict with Beijing. And that's something that Beijing really wants to resolve amicably and to its own benefit. And to the extent that it can get the Philippines on board, it alienates Vietnam. And that's a much bigger problem for China than the Philippines.
Anyway, it's depressing. It's depressing because, basically the President of the United States doesn't have to meet with this pipsqueak monster. That's the story. He won with a plurality, but, leagues away from even winning a majority in his own country.
Sounds familiar.
But leagues away. Leagues away. Trump can meet with whom he wants to meet with. That's the ultimate story, including if Ivanka says, meet with this guy, or Jared says, meet with this guy, because it's good for for the company, because the only real disciplinary action that can be taken against such behavior is impeachment. There is no legal remedy to take on the president for having meetings that might benefit his company. That's what people still have to get their minds around, and clearly the Republican Congress and the Republican Senate aren't going to vote 2/3 to impeach Trump unless his numbers fall into the teens or something. So, he can sort of act at will if that's what he's going to do. And, one of the reasons that if he's doing it, that he's somewhat ashamed or nervous or abashed about it is that they won't admit it.
See, I think there's also an answer that lies in Trump's unseriousness, which is that I think he likes meeting with heads of state. I think he likes the pomp around it. He likes to come out saying, we had a very productive meeting. We had good all this weird thing. We have good chemistry, he likes to say. He likes the photo. I think it makes him feel like he's doing what a statesman is supposed to do. I think he thinks that he can talk to anyone, especially eccentrics,
Well, he's actually meeting with a much lower figure, means that his own status is, even though you really don't need to be status conscious if you're the president of the United States, if you bring the status consciousness to the office rather than, and without filling the office, maybe that's good. He also has the continuing vanity of the, look, good guys, bad guys, you can always get people together in a room and make a deal. He just said this, gobsmacking thing to somebody this morning about the Civil War, about Andrew Jackson and the Civil War and how, how did the Civil War happen? Andrew Jackson was really upset about that. Andrew Jackson, who died 16 years before the Civil War started, and basically
nobody really
asks
about why the Civil War happened.
It's an event that is shrouded in mysteries, fallen into the. No one writes books about it. Nobody has interpreted it. you know, it's really one of those things that just happened and no one really has any
opinions
about it. If
you don't
do
any reading about it, you never know. It's like a tree falling in the forest. He doesn't know about any of the
I know. If only there were TV shows about it and movies about it and, you know, speeches given by prior presidents at their second inaugurals that are only 545 words long that summarize the reasons for the Civil War and the greatest at work of rhetoric ever produced by any leader in the history of the world, and, you know, pretty accessible and short. I mean, basically it is 540 words, and, you know, I think even Trump could read 540 words in one sitting, or could be broken up into a PowerPoint sentence by sentence if he likes those. Apparently, I don't think he likes that. He likes graphics, I think.
We're going off on a tangent, but his, you know, infatuation with Andrew Jackson has been imposed on him. He didn't read about Andrew Jackson before he ran for the presidency. He was informed by those who read history that you're like Andrew Jackson, and you should really like Andrew Jackson and read a little bit about Andrew Jackson and go to Tennessee and talk to people about Andrew Jackson.
No, but funny thing is he said people in Tennessee love Andrew Jackson. It's weird, by the way, because the state of Tennessee, of all the states in the South, is politically and ideologically and historically very divided. There's a part of Tennessee that really wanted to stay in the was opposed to the Confederate cause, did not support Jacksonian politics, and, you know, it's not the best state to choose if what you want to do is invoke Jacksonian theory or behavior. South Carolina might be, or, you know, would be much closer, no matter where Jackson, you know, might or might not be from. But there we have it. So congratulations to our president for, you know. Noah, what was your idea? Trump history?
Trump history. Like,
yeah, sort of like drunk history. History, right. Correct. So you just like you would sort of illustrate Trump's
just
descriptions
waxing,
of,
you know,
yeah,
free of history. Form, you know, extemporaneously on thoughts on history.
Yeah, right. Like, what was it he said? Didn't he seem to suggest he thought Harriet Tubman was alive? Was it Harriet
Frederick
Tubman?
Douglas.
Oh, Frederick
yeah,
Douglas.
Right.
That's
right. It could show Frederick Douglas gaining support in 2017,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, look, I honestly, so, you know, it's 3.5 months into this presidency, and he is who he is, and we have to sort of reconcile ourselves to it, but... here in the case of Duterte, we have a, you know, so if he says ridiculous things about the Civil War, big deal. Or if he says ridiculous things about Andrew Jackson, big deal. But it is a big deal when the decisions that he makes about what is going on in the world at the moment and what message that conveys. You know, what if, I mean, Duterte is killing people in the streets, right? As you said, 7,000 people. It's only been a year. He's only been in office for a year. So it's not Bashar al-Assad. It's not at the Syrian level. It's not a civil war in which he's trying to, you know, roust out his own people. But, you know, you're talking about what could be 40, 50,000 people. There's very little difference between this and the cause, you know, in the desaparecidos in Argentina, I mean, or you know, other...
And the Philippines has an Islamist militancy problem, Abu Sayyaf, which apparently this administration, the Duterte administration, is seeking accommodation with.
Right, because they want its help in combating this drug problem.
Correct. Which is really a social. I mean, it's a throwback to this sort of social ideal of the perfect Filipino, who it's not about cohesion or the economy or anything that tangible. It's sort of this envisioned ideal of what a Filipino person is supposed to be. It's a very much a 20th century sort of vision of totalitarianism.
And, you know, and this is the downside, the famous... So basically Duterte is the tough-on-crime president. That's how he got elected. That's who he is. He's the populist tough-on-crime president. Which is clearly why Trump feels some kind of weird affinity toward him. And the funny thing is that, you know, compared to Duterte in the world of being a tough guy, like he's a piker, sort of like Putin, like Trump and Putin. Like whatever happens, you know, Trump seems to admire this kind of I don't care about the niceties. I'm gonna do what I have to do, and you know, you can all go stuff it. But of course, when push comes to shove, as far as we know, he's not willing to go that way. He wants to talk that way, and he wants to rant that way and act like he's a talk show caller. But in the end, you know, as people were saying last week, during the whole 100 days thing, what's most shocking about him is that, with the exception of the badly drafted executive orders that have not been, you know, that have not been implemented, it's, you know, it's not as though he's a tough guy president who has been being really tough and being a tough guy. I mean, he went off this weekend and, you know, gave a very similar speech to one of the ones that he gave during the campaign, trashing the New York Times and the media in general in front of a crowd in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. What was really surprising about it, or sort of startling about it, was how there seemed to be no effort to connect what he was saying to what it was that he wanted to do. You know, presidents, if he wants to attack the media, because he would say they are trying very hard to block my agenda or make it difficult for what you need, you Americans need. That was the Spiro Agnew silent, you know, the Spiro Agnew attack on the media and the silent majority approach. And 1969, 1970 was the media were attempting to delegitimize the solutions that were going to help make American people's lives better. That was not present in what the president talked about. What was present was they stink, they're failing, no one believes them, they're all fake news, and, you know, that's terrible.
It's like that's Trump, the cultural voice. He's giving voice to his supporters. That's his role there. And that's a very different animal from Trump, the president, now there's a deal to fund the government that in fact doesn't account for any of the sort of hard, tough policies that he had wanted, like funding the wall,
right?
Like taking away federal funding for
Planned Parenthood.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what's funny, though, is that there is now, this weekend, a spate of stories released about the Democratic Party and analyses that are being done by Democratic organizations about what went wrong on Election Day and what lessons there are to be drawn. Very interesting story released by the McClatchy News Service, a piece by Greg Sargent in the Washington Post, all of which suggests that the Democrats fell prey to the notion, largely because of their results in 2012 that got Obama reelected, that if they could just spin out their base and get their base to vote, that Hillary would prevail. And that, in fact, the story of 2016 was the cratering of a certain type of Hillary vote and the fact that there was this small but statistically significant, particularly in the states that Trump won, that Obama had carried, that there was the small but statistically of Obama to Trump voters. And that what this suggested was this notion that that the base was settled, the Democratic base was a settled fact and was going to vote the way that everybody expected they had voted in 2008 and 2012, was a false set of expectations, and that no effort was made to appeal to the white working class that handed the election. White working class people who were so racist and, you know, and white supremacist that they voted for Obama, both in 2008 and 2012.
Despite apparently being pretty much abandoned by the campaign in 2011.
I know, because they're, because they're such white supremacists that they voted for Obama anyway.
But that was, and you've mentioned this before, that was the fatal conceit of the Obama campaign, is that they could get elected, and were right, by abandoning elements of the New Deal coalition, but no other Democrat really could.
Right, because it was very specific. Whatever it was very specific to Obama. Whatever Obama's appeal was entirely specific to Obama. And there's a cautionary example in this to Trump, which is, remember, Trump got 46% of the vote, not 48. He got the right voters in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Ohio, but he didn't get, you know, but he didn't win even a majority. He was 3 million votes shy of Hillary. And his vote may be his vote, but he's going to need more people to vote for him next time than this time, presumably because Democrats, unless they are literally willing to jump off a cliff and destroy their party based on short, which may happen, and we should talk about that for a minute, will correct for some of these mistakes, just as, you know, and will figure out that they need to speak to these people enough to not have the cratering effect that they had in these very important, you know, what are now swing states that were not swing states before. And if Trump doesn't figure out a way to broaden his message a little bit, to talk to the people who aren't just interested in hearing how the media sucks, that's going to be, you know, important for him.
But I think the Democrats are going to have a very hard time crafting this new message that's about economic populism, also melded with these kind of boutique-y identity issues and environmentalism. You know, there's a sort of a lot that they have to weave together to make that happen.
So I wrote about this on Friday when I was talking about Elizabeth Warren's attack on Barack Obama for taking Wall Street money, which, by the way, was absolute gibberish. If you actually transcribed it, which I did, it was nonsense. She didn't say anything coherent. She talked about how advertising works and that's bad. Literally. It was insane. But Democrats are kind of in different areas of politics are responding to different incentive structures. Like this pro-life thing was really illustrative. Apparently there's a pro-life candidate in Omaha who got sort of smacked.
Democrat
who's who got he didn't get praised by Bernie Sanders, and then Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez sort of said that there's or said explicitly that there's really no home for pro-life Democrats in the Democratic Party. And Nancy Pelosi actually gave him a little smack on the wrist over that because she needs a majority, and that's how you get you don't get a majority by alienating people. But that's not what Tom Perez cares about right now. Tom Perez needs money. He needs to raise money from the Democratic donor class, and they want a totally homogeneous, which do you prefer, homogeneous or
homogeneous?
Homogeneous, ideologically, party. So that's why you have no autopsy, or at least no public autopsy. Apparently we're seeing some stuff happen, as this McClatchy article demonstrates, on the sides, on the fringes. But if they were to conduct a real
They're not fringes. I mean, they are mainstream. They just happen to be not official
Democratic organizations. But it's not like a 2012 autopsy where we have a set of recommendations and and a directive for the party to follow these recommendations.
Which were then ignored.
Because they'd be contradicted by their actual results, and it would really deflate the Democratic donor base.
But here, there are two ways of looking at this. One of which is that the secret to Hillary's defeat in 2016 was this vanity that they could reconstitute the Obama vote of 2012 almost exactly. I mean, a lot of us believed this, and that that she just didn't have all of it. You know, she got 95% of it, and that 5% made an enormous difference in having her lose it. And that there are two ways of going about this in 2020, one of which is to go at the very phenomena that make it possible for that vote to be reconstituted. And I mean, the most obvious blatant way would be to nominate another black person at the top of the ticket. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that when they look at what their problems are, it may be enough to say, I care. See, it may be enough to say, I care, I hear you, I feel your pain, all of that, that Obama did not have to say. In fact, he, you know, and not to make the off-the-mic mistakes that every candidate now seems to make, right? So Obama did the, you know, they cling to their guns and religion off the record, and it got out in 2008, but not enough to hurt him, but, you know, basically a reflection of something. Romney said 47% off the record, and it got out, and she said deplorables off the record, and it got out.
You didn't build that was kind of a on-mic mistake.
But that was an on-mic mistake. That wasn't, that he did that, he said that in public without, he wanted people to hear that. But I think it's much more important saying your voters, these other voters, they're idiots. They're idiots. They're stupid. Their issues don't matter, or they're bad people, which is what Hillary said. So, A, if you don't make that mistake anymore, you assume that there's literally nothing that you were going to say that isn't going to be, you know, you need to be anodyne rather than punchy. Or if you're going to be punchy, be more punchy, not less punchy. If you're going to say deplorables, go at it like be Trumpian about it. Don't be like Hillary about it, like you say it, and then despite the fact, I'm going to do it again, that Noah thought that this was by design, the fact that they all went, uh-oh, and then they backed off it as opposed to, you're damn right they're deplorable. They are deplorable. They make me sick. It's disgusting. You know, like that. Maybe that, you know, at least she would then have gotten points for principle or something like that. But I think you can do the sort of mushiness and say, I care, I care, I care, I care, I care, particularly if after Trump doesn't manage to do anything to help them. Like, he's not going to bring back the coal industry. He's not going to bring back the steel industry in 4 years. And, you know, basically you can then say, well, he sold you a bill of goods and I really care, so I'm going to make you totally dependent on government, and I'm, if you, what you want is dependency on government, I'm here for you, you know, something like that.
Right. I mean, there's also the on the record mistakes, the insane Hillary one of talking about how she's going to put all coal workers out of work.
Right.
I mean, that is a response, right, to certain incentives on the left about the environment.
But it's also this question of what kind of feel you have. So, you know, look, Obama was a brilliant politician. He got more votes than anyone has ever gotten, and it'll be a long time before someone gets as many votes as he got in 2008. And he had a feel for this game of saying, you know, I'm beyond ideology. I want to bring people together. You know, I, even though he didn't mean it, but he had a genius for it. And Trump has had a genius in some ways for, you know, expressing a giant idea and defending it. You know, America's not great. We're going to make it great again. And Hillary had nothing whatsoever.
Well, I think
as the book shattered reveals. She had nothing. She had nothing. She, they didn't know why she was running for president. They had nothing. And so they're going to need something next time. But if that something is you all suck, you know, unless you want, you know, unless you want your children to be, you know, taught how to become transgender, you'll stink, then it'll go on the same way. I think that's not that hard to correct for.
But I think it's also worth mentioning that both Obama and Trump were the center of political personality cults to the extent that we have that in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the people who are susceptible to that kind of thing are those people who are feeling disenfranchised, who need something, that who aren't having their needs met. And it makes perfect sense that they would go from Obama to Trump.
I mean, so who's disenfranchised now after 8 years of Obama, 4 years of Trump? What, sensible, intellectually rigorous moderates?
Kind of, yes, that's right.
That's right.
Yeah, but there's also no. I mean, there's also no guarantee that we don't want a sort of another personality cult to come sweeping through our politics either. But right. I mean, but that had a lot
but
to
look,
do.
But look, all Democrats keep saying is, you know, a changeover of 100,000 votes in three states, and Hillary would be president, having won with a margin of, you know, 2.5%, and that's true. So the question is, if it's 100,000 people, which is not an insignificant amount of people, even though it sounds like it in an electorate of 100, you know, of 132 or 133 million, or 128, I can't remember what the total number is, but what is it that you need to say just to, you know, just to make them switch back? And it can't be that they are hearing things and seeing things from Trump that they can't be seduced away from, because in the absence of wildly successful policy initiatives, you know, it's going to be, I don't know what he's going to do, you know, what they're going to do, why they won't be up for grabs. Now, they're not going to be up for grabs if the party goes the Tom Perez route and says, we believe only this one thing.
Well, it's my thought and guess that this approach that he's taking right now is for the explicitly for the benefit of the committees that are trying to raise money right now. And then once the 2018 cycle revs up in earnest, then we're going to see a pivot. And we are starting to see the 2018 cycle materialize. It's a much less clearer picture than I think some people anticipate, with the announcement of the retirement of Ileana Ross Lightning in Florida. Some people are suggesting that this means that it's an unfavorable environment for Republicans because she's in a pretty blue district and has been reelected many times in the past, and this district now leans Democratic with her retirement. But then there are also
Lean Democratic. It is now, I think even the Cook Political Report has now put it as likely Democratic.
University of Virginia has it lean.
Right, that's Larry Sabato. So the reason is that it went 20%. Ileana Ross Lightning has been representing the district for 28 years. It went 20% for Hillary. No, 20%. Trump.
Well, then you have
Hillary beat Trump by 20% in the district, and that's just the fact of it. So Ileana Ross Lightning may be retiring because they've done a couple of polls, and it's like, obviously, you can't say that a incumbent is going to lose, but maybe she's like, I don't want to spend a year and a half,
sure,
in trench warfare. I'm too old, and you know, I've been in politics for 40 years now, and maybe I can get out and make a little money and you know, do whatever I can do otherwise.
And Republicans, as you did some more research on this, which I'm sure we'll get into, Republicans in South Florida and Southern California that are really, you know, trending blue and have been going that direction for a long time, they might continue to get out. But then you have Democrats in places like Montana's at-large district, which is going for a special election to replace Interior Secretary Ryan Zink. And Zinke. Again, I need to watch more television because
Zinke.
I don't know how anybody's name is
you got to go with
exclusively I don't watch television, I don't listen to the radio, so I don't know how to pronounce anyone's name anymore. It's becoming a real problem.
You know, I worked at Time Magazine 30 years ago, and whenever there was a politician's name that was clearly not easily pronounceable, we actually would put in parentheses pronounced blank. Like for anyone, because Candy. It was presumed that people read and that they needed some pronunciation guide to somebody's odd name, and you know, no one does that now.
Because the
lying media are failing.
Well, also, I think few people would understand the pronunciation signs.
No, they don't even understand date lines. Apparently, we're getting rid of those.
No, it wouldn't like the upside down backwards E or anything.
I see.
It
would phonetically.
Zinke would be zinc hyphen and then. Like three E's.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, so in that race, there is a rather colorful Democrat who plays the guitar and wears a 10-gallon hat and looks like somebody from Montana. And he's going to be palling around with Mitt Romney, which tells you a little something about how these people in Trump country view the electorate, too. It's not just Ileana Ross Lightning's who are getting out, but some, you know, Democrats who are inching towards Republicans.
Well, remember that in the big special election we were talking about just a couple of weeks ago, the one that Democrat John Ossoff got 48% of the vote in the district of now HHS Secretary Tom Price, that the Republicans who were fighting amongst each other did not embrace Trump. Karen Handel, who is the one who was going to be running against Ossoff, barely talked about Trump because the notion that that district is not a Trump district. He won it by one percentage point. Ileana Ross Lightning was going to be a vote for Ileana Ross Lightning as a vote for Trump in a district that Trump lost by 20. There are 10 districts with candidates up in 2018, since they're up every 2 years. There are 10 districts that Republicans now sit in that Hillary won by more than 8 points. 10. So if that flips, if all 10 of those flip, and 8 points is a lot of points, and you know, one of them is Daryl Issa, the Republican, you know, sort of attack dog investigator, and he has now twice barely won. One, you know, with like the tiniest of margins, both in 2014 and 2016, and you know, unfavorable trend against Trump will be the thing that knocks him over. Similarly, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Ed Royce, who is also in a district that was, I think, 8% Hillary over Trump. Very nice guy. I've known him for like 30 years and a good congressman and solid. Is going to be if the Trump foreign policy is not viewed as successful, Royce will be linked to Trump, not only because Democrats don't like Trump, but because he will be forced in the position of having to say nice things about Trump's foreign policy, which will gin up the Democratic base. The question is, in a midterm election, Republicans have turned out for midterms, and Democrats didn't during the Obama years, but Democrats did turn out in 2006 when Republicans did not, because they were crushed and depressed not only by Iraq and New Orleans and the hurricane, but also by these sex scandals, pages, you know, congressmen chasing male pages around and that sort of thing, that, you know, really made that a total debacle. That was 32 seats that the Democrats won in 2006. I believe it's 32. So the question is, can Democrats keep their heads and not go totally insane? Then you have the flip side argument, which is Victor Davis Hanson's argument, that 2020 could be 1972. That is to say, Richard Nixon won by an incredibly narrow margin over Hubert Humphrey in 1968. He won 43% of the vote. Humphrey got like 42.5. Nixon wins. And in 72, he wins the largest landslide in American history. He gets 62% against George McGovern's 37. Why? It's not like things were terrible. Vietnam wasn't going well. We instituted wage and price controls. It was all terrible. But the Democratic Party appeared psychotic. That was what happened. They had supported, there were riots in 68. They were supporting massive action. They were being soft on crime. They were being anti-American in foreign policy. And they nominated the most left-wing person ever to run for office in George McGovern. You can kind of see that as a Democrats are getting soft on crime, are saying that we're over-incarcerating people. They're going crazy about the death penalty in a lot of places now. Now we're in a low crime, and we're not in a crime spree. We're in a low crime. And so it's not beyond the bounds of probability that Democrats, who should be in a position to kind of crush the GOP in 2018 and maybe in 2020, could go in the other direction and McGovernize themselves.
Well, look, we have this analysis now that says that the Democrats failed because of these voters that went from Obama to Trump, that they need to adopt a message of economic populism to reach these people. But nationally, where is all the activism, all the rallies? These are not rallies about economic populism and jobs for poor people. Right. These are sort of coastal identity issues. These are sort of Hillary supporters. Climate change are wearing wacky hats. They are not going to get this memo.
I would also caution that McGovern could win. It's not a given necessarily that the Democratic Party has to change at all to benefit from a pendulum swing in American public opinion. They could be very comfortable and settle into their liberal activist progressivism. And Donald Trump could be unpopular enough to be unseated by a McGovernite liberal.
Absolutely. He could, if what is discussed bears some relation to the lives of the people who vote. That's the issue, which is, I think, what Abe brings up. In other words, the accelerant effect of the protests in 2017 – the money that's being raised, $9 million raised by John Ossoff in a congressional race, the fact that they can bring millions of people out into the streets for some of these marches, the fact that they're so focused and Republicans are squabbling amongst each other with single-party rule, right, with the Senate and the House and the presidency in the hands of Republicans, and nothing is getting done even so. They can't get health care done. They can't get it. Clearly, the tax cut is somehow kind of dead on arrival. Trump is now announcing there'll be an infrastructure bill in 2 weeks, which is ridiculous. Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council, is saying that there will be another healthcare bill this week.
There will have been a healthcare vote, according to Gary Cohn.
Which just shows that you can run Goldman Sachs and apparently be an effective head of Goldman Sachs and know nothing about politics. There is not going to be a healthcare bill this week. There wasn't last week, and nothing's getting better. On the healthcare front, You know what? I lost my train of thought. I have
You said that A. McGovern could win if he's talking about.
My point is that Trump is, you know, they still have to, the Republicans still have to show that they can function. Remember, the thing about Nixon was he was a minority president with a hostile Congress, and he really could say, like, the Democrats and the Democrats in Congress and stuff like that are actually hostile. They do not want America to win this war. They don't want me to lock up criminals. They don't want, you know, they are not interested in the things that trouble you, the silent majority, right? That's what he said. And I'm saying that Democrats could, in theory, all this stuff is an accelerant for them. But if they aren't able to talk to ordinary people, who don't care about transgender issues, you know, if we're talking about transgender issues, if 15 or 20% of the conversation in 2020 is about transgender issues, Democrats are not going to win the presidency.
But Think of what happened with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. That dominated the primary, and it disappeared in the general election.
No, it didn't. Absolutely, it did not. Hillary Clinton was forced to stay on the left of the party because she thought that she needed those voters and she didn't have them in hand. So this book Shattered, the first book about the Hillary Clinton, describes the kind of paranoia, the ultimate Hillary paranoia about not being having to nail down the Democratic ideological base, which was not nailed down by the time she won the nomination.
She wasn't out there hammering these themes. She could not move Democratic to the right. National Convention, which was about as Republican a Democratic National Convention as I've seen in my lifetime.
Bill Clinton, they said you should do X, Y, and Z, and part of it was, if I do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to alienate the Sanders voters. And remember, Sanders, she was up 26 points in the Michigan primary and lost. Last polling in Michigan had her winning by 25 or something like that, and she lost the primary. And they didn't know whether or not they were going to... She ended up winning the state by a point, right? So she knew something, even though the whole thing is about how she was so stupid. Had she moved to the left, maybe she would have alienated the Sanders voters that she needed without getting enough of the Trump voters. She got just what she needed to prevail in that state. I'm just saying the notion that she can, that any Democrat can just move to the right is not proven.
Yeah,
and Mitt Romney could not move to the left because he did not have the Republican base solidified. He could not move to the center. You remember the whole thing where his campaign aide, Eric Fernstrom, said, this is great because, you know, it's like Etch-a-Sketch. You win the primary, then you shake it up, and then you start over in the general. And it's like, uh-oh. You know, he basically had to spend 3 months saying, it's not Etch-a-Sketch. I'm not Etch-a-Sketch. I have principles. I'm severely conservative. You know, and he couldn't do what he should have done.
Yeah, I mean, and whether it's transgender issues exactly, the point is that the activism, the money, the huge crowds, it's all about diversity, inclusivity, climate change. None of it has the momentum is not where the analysis is saying it should be, which is on economic populism for those who feel left
out. I mean, they could lean into economic inequality again. I mean, that was the Democratic. They thought that economic inequality was their version of talking to the Trump voter. So now they're yelling about Barack Obama making $400,000 for a speech because that's Democratic economic populism. That's bad. He shouldn't. Right. It's like, what difference does it make? He's not running for office again. Right. He can do whatever the hell he wants. By the way, this is one of the jokes. Talk about going totally off topic. So Barack Obama, everyone's yelling, oh, Barack Obama got $45 million, you know, got $400,000 a speech. It's terrible, right? Barack and Michelle together have book advances to the tune of $65 million. Who do you think gives advances like this? These are the firms that we're bidding, these are multinational conglomerates. These aren't like, it's not like Farrar, Straus, and Giroux of old sitting in a building and owned by one eccentric rich guy or Charles Scribner. I mean, these are multinational conglomerates. I can't remember who his publisher is, who Obama's publisher is and Michelle's publisher is. I think they have the same one.
It's the same book.
Oh, it's the same book, right. Yeah.
They're writing a book together.
Right. So basically, together, they have $65 million. That's a much bigger deal in terms of conflict of interest than a $400,000 speech. But their version is, oh, Wall Street's evil, book publishers are good, so it's fine. You know, it's crazy. But what's not crazy is that we've come to an end of another Commentary Magazine podcast. Commentary, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, cultural analysis, and political theory from a conservative perspective. Join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe for $19.95, which gets you a digital subscription, and $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription, iPad, and a beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. So give us a shot, take a read, enjoy what we do. We're proud of it. We've got a lot of good stuff for you to read. All you got to do is pay some bucks. Think about it. It's not even $2 a month. Give us a shot. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.